Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
A rested child is a happy child. Sleep Tight Stories is a weekly podcast that brings comfort and joy to families worldwide with calming bedtime stories. The stories are relevant to children and spark wonder without overstimulation, so they can fall asleep and stay asleep. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. For a bedtime routine you'll miss when they're grown, Sleep Tight Stories.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And this is Joe McCormick.
And this week on Weird House Cinema, we are obviously tackling G2. We're going to be looking at 1990's Gremlins 2, The New Batch. This is Joe Dante's colossal sequel to the 1984 film Gremlins.
Which I had assumed when we picked it was a Christmas movie, but yes. It's not. The original Gremlins is a Christmas movie. G2 might well be in June, for all I know.
Yeah, it was released in June. But yeah, I had this false memory in my head that this too was a Christmas movie. And evidently I'm not alone. I think it sounds like you had the same thing in your brain. And I rented the Blu-ray from Videodrome here in Atlanta, the video store here in Atlanta. And they had it categorized with Christmas movies as well for the holidays. So I guess this is like a collective misremembering that we're engaging in here.
So it doesn't take place at Christmas, but it is a Christmas tree of a movie, and it overfloweth with lights and shiny objects and presents spilling forth from beneath the boughs.
Absolutely. Now, I strongly remember the buildup to this film's release. I would have been 11 at the time. It was set to come out in June. Gremlins 2 merchandise was everywhere. The film seemed just destined to satisfy everyone. The trailers just looked fun, even though I don't think I'd actually seen Gremlins 1 at that point, or maybe I'd seen parts of it on TV or something, but I was convinced Gremlins 2 was going to change the world. Of course, it didn't really change the world. The box office numbers ended up being, I think, disappointing. The critical reception was kind of mixed at the time. Mm-hmm. I was not aware of any of this, so I stayed strong with my desire to see Gremlins 2. And when it finally became available on home video, I got to rent it. I got to watch it. And even then, at age 11, I realized this film was a lot.
Did the presence of the Hulkster have any sway with you at this time?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Was it only later you would come to appreciate pro wrestling?
Yeah, that would come later for me. At the time, you know, you knew who Hulk Hogan was because he was a superstar. Spoiler, but Hulk Hogan is in the movie. He's one of many cameos, many appearances in this film.
You know, I think Gremlins 2 is kind of ahead of its time. I do see that critical reception at the time was mixed. I think a lot of people didn't know what to make of this movie, but I think if something like this updated a bit for more modern sensibilities came out now, I think the reaction might be more resounding appreciation.
Yeah, I don't know if someone could pull it off as well as Joe Dante and his team here did, though, because this is one of those rare films that is very self-aware, and yet delivers. Like, it knows it's goofy. It's going for goofy. It's breaking the fourth wall. It's making fun of the previous Gremlins movie. It's totally wild in this regard. And this is the same kind of self-awareness that has driven many other films just straight into the ditch as far as watchability and enjoyability goes.
Yeah, I would say it's kind of the Evil Dead 2 to Gremlins Evil Dead 1, except whereas the Evil Dead movies are kind of a parlor drama. They take place in a single location. They're very focused. This is a voluminous, crazy, overflowing extravaganza.
Yeah, yeah. And I think over time, people have come to realize that Gremlins 2 is something special. It's definitely grown a cult following over time. There was that wonderful Key and Peele sketch about the Hollywood sequel doctor,
yes,
which is 100% correct, and yet doesn't even like tease half of the weirdness and the oddities that pop up in this film. Like, if just the things in that sketch were in the film, it would already be insane. But that's just half the story.
Yeah.
So I think I have to realize, especially after rewatching it, I have to admit that 11-year-old me was absolutely right to be excited about G2, and it was and is, in fact, the greatest Gremlin movie we could possibly hope for.
Well, 100% agree. I did not see Gremlins 2 when I was a kid, but I did see Gremlins 1. My dad and I rented it, probably from Turtles Video, when I was in elementary school, and I remember it being a real mood rattler because it has that mix of cute, cuddly kid stuff, like Gizmo is so adorable, and then mixing that with bizarrely depressing themes and gruesome violence.
Yeah.
But despite this mix, I'm pretty sure I loved it at the time. And I was trying to remember the things that stuck out to me about the film, the things that really lodged in my memory. I remember, of course, Gizmo being very cute. I remember the rules, right? There's an important part early on when the father character buys Gizmo from the antique shop, and he is told the three rules you cannot violate. You cannot shine sunlight, bright light, especially sunlight, on the Mogwai, because that will kill it. Number two is you can never get it wet. And number three is you can never feed it after midnight.
Yeah, these rules are great. They're a real head scratcher to try and analyze. The Gremlins 2 itself pokes a little fun at this. And many years ago, I had great fun when I was writing for How Stuff Works, doing a How Stuff Works article about Gremlins and Mogwai, where I made a go at describing the science behind all these weird things that they do. But you really have to twist yourself into a knot to do that kind of thing.
The other things I remember, though, Gremlins being killed by Billy's mom with kitchen appliances. I think one gets in the blender, she turns it on. Another one gets in the microwave, she turns it on. So appliances to the rescue. I also remember the Gremlins at one point watching Snow White in the movie theater. And I think Zach Galligan playing the main human character, Billy, he's like, they're watching Snow White and they love it. And I also remember a scene of gremlins raucously partying at a bar. And there's one shot where a gremlin is smoking three cigarettes at the same time, which was hilarious to my little brain. But then the big thing that stuck in my head, maybe more than anything else, involves no gremlins at all. Not a gremlin to be seen. It was a part in the movie where Phoebe Cates is delivering a monologue about how her father died while trying to crawl down the family's chimney dressed in a Santa Claus suit.
Yeah, that just a real bummer of a scene, which is, I think, one of the big reasons that the film was so jarring and so tonally inconsistent. I think I grew to realize this as a kid, because when you're a kid, you kind of treat movies like you treat people. You take them at face value. You don't pick and say, well, I wish this was different, I wish that was different. It's like, well, this is the film. So it's a little jarring when you encounter a film like Gremlins that seems to be divided about whether it's a cute film or a horror film, etc. And this scene's just horrific, and I don't recall it really accomplishing much for the picture either.
I mean, it's hard to, I think it was maybe supposed to be darkly comedic, but it's hard to tell. Anyway, this infamous soliloquy is parodied in G2. So you got to appreciate a sequel that directly makes fun of the original film. Like there's a part where Phoebe Cates starts to launch into a monologue about how she has horrible associations with President's Day because there was a man dressed in an Abe Lincoln suit. And before she can finish it, they kind of just usher her off screen.
Yeah, they're like, we don't have time for this. We've got to go defeat the gremlins.
So I wasn't really aware of Gremlins 2 until probably college when a friend of mine told me, we were talking about Gremlins. He was like, you ever see the second one? And I said, no. And he was like, you've got to watch it because there's a scene where Hulk Hogan appears as himself talking directly into the camera, which confused me because, you know, I'd seen the original and that did not seem in keeping with the level of reality in which the original movie is set. I mean, of course, it's got fantasy elements, but It's a film that maintains its own realism.
Yeah, I will say, and we'll get to the Hulk Hogan scene. The Hulk Hogan scene is 100% earned.
Yes.
It does not feel jarring when it happens in the film. But yeah, I can understand where just knowing this about the film could set weird expectations for what it is. But I'm also glad that you again mentioned the gremlins watching Snow White in the first one, the gremlins smoking and all, because I think one would be making an error in hating on G2 by holding G1 to some unrealistic, like, serious standard that it wasn't going for either.
No, Gremlins 1 is also supposed to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
But G2 goes to heights unimagined by the first film. So the original Gremlins is very weird. It's kind of hard to say who it's for. Like, is this an R-rated horror movie or a cute Christmas movie for kids? It's kind of both. But I think it's great. And though a bit of that DNA gets passed on to the sequel, ultimately I think G2 is something different, and it is the purest essence of gremlins. Because what are gremlins with a lowercase g? They are not just any movie monster. Most movie monsters are more than anything a threat. They are scary because they endanger the lives of the characters. They're scary because they will kill. The gremlins in these movies do participate in violence, but the violence seems kind of secondary. It's just sort of one of their tricks. The violence is one of the outcome paths of their overall mission, which I think would be better designated as just chaos. The gremlins represent anarchy, disorder, the dangerous and destructive side of fun. And in both movies, but especially the second, you see the gremlins playing mean pranks and partying and breaking things and making a mess.
Yeah, the classic Dungeons and Dragons alignment system just breaks down in the face of gremlins because they would have to be, they couldn't be chaotic evil. They couldn't be like chaotic neutral. They'd have to be chaotic, chaotic, which just breaks the system. But fortunately, gremlins love to break things. So I guess it works out.
Yes, when it's time to party, they will party hard. And they will party so hard that there's just broken glass flying all over the place. There's, you know, like the rooms that they inhabit are quickly come to be filled with smoke and fumes for various reasons. And this actually, in a thematically wise decision, connects to the origin of the gremlin as a broader creature. Gremlins, unlike most mythical monsters, do not originate in the myths and folk beliefs of pre-modern times. Gremlins are a 20th century creation. They're part of the culture of aeronautics and piloting. I believe particularly the British RAF, who made reference to gremlins as these devilish little saboteurs and mischief makers who would walk around inside the engine with a big pair of scissors and cut the wires while you were in mid-flight for a deadly prank. Gremlins play horrible jokes. Gremlins break things. Gremlins break the rules. Gremlins make a mess. And these antics end up with people maimed or dead. In fact, Rob, I attached a couple of things for you to look at here. These are posters from the World War II era saying, you know, basically watch out for gremlins as a metaphor for saying be careful in the workplace.
Mm.
Because the gremlins could push you into the saw if you're not careful. The gremlins could fling things in your eyes if you're not careful. You got to wear the safety goggles. You got to keep a distance from the saw blade.
Don't let the grimsters get you.
So seeing as they're not your average movie monster, but rather avatars of chaos, that, you know, just mischief and entropy, I think gremlins deserve something different from your average monster movie. And in G2, that is exactly what they got. this movie is absolute chaos. It does not tell a conventional story with a conventional plot. It does not attempt to maintain the suspension of disbelief. Like, there's not integrity of its setting as a real world within the film. Instead, G2 just wants to show you things. It's a lot of, hey, look at this. And some of those things will be weird images, like, hey, here's a gremlin made out of vegetables. It's got tomatoes for cheeks. Or here's a gremlin with spider legs. Sometimes those things will be bizarre scenes, like the talk show interview where the brainy gremlin explains what the gremlins want. And it turns out what they want is civilization. Or the part where there's like a chorus of gremlins singing New York, New York. Sometimes it's going to be visual gags, like where the gremlin with bat wings flies through a wall and leaves a hole that is the Tim Burton Batman symbol. Or just sometimes going to be out of nowhere, fourth wall breaking gags, like when Hulk Hogan yells at us, or when we see the film critic Leonard Maltin show up to give a 1-star review of Gremlins 1, only to then be murdered by gremlins.
Oh, it's such a great scene. I mean, both of these scenes are great. Like, the Hulk Hogan scene, of course, is that the gremlins have disrupted the film projector in the theater in which we are ideally watching the film. And then we're sort of there are many layers to it.
Yeah, it's so weird. No, we should actually try to describe what happens there, just to give you a flavor of the, like, how many walls are being broken. Mm-hmm. They break up to like the eighth wall. Yeah. So you're watching the movie, and then suddenly it looks as if the film you are watching that's been projected in the theater has been destroyed. Like, it kind of burns mm-hmm. through, and then the screen turns white. And then you see gremlins making shadow puppets in front of the projector. And then we zoom out to see inside a theater. So I guess presumably at first you were tricked into thinking something has happened on the screen and you're in the theater, but now you're looking at a theater on the screen. And in the theater, there's Hulk Hogan. Oh, there's a lady who walks out of the theater and complains to theater manager, played by Paul Bartel, yes. saying like, this movie is trash. And he's like, we don't make the movies, man. We just show them.
And the mom, by the way, is Belinda Blaski. Who appears in a number of Joe Dante's films, like The Howling, the original Gremlins, and Piranha.
Yeah, and then the Hulkster shows up, and the Hulkster threatens the Gremlins. I think he's like, I'm going to come up there, and I'm going to show you who's boss.
And they listen. They listen. They back down.
Yeah. So G2 is not just a movie about Gremlins. It was made by gremlins. Gremlins have taken over the script, the camera, the editing. And in that sense, I think it's almost sort of an art film. G2 is genius.
It is. There's as much as I love the Key and Peele sketch. I've watched it so many times. And it is, at one level, it is 100% correct about the vibe of the film. And I think Joe Dante and folks have also said that they enjoy it and think some of it matches up with the experience. But on the other hand, yes, this is not a slapdash film. This is a film that knows exactly what it is going for, and it succeeds at creating that experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think the result is a very enjoyable film. It's a great film. I'll say it. G2 is a great film. I think it's better than Dances with Wolves, which won the Oscar that year.
For Best Picture. G2 yeah. should have taken Best Picture.
Well, maybe.
What's the elevator pitch on G2?
The first one that came to my mind is Gremlins Take Manhattan, and I think that's it.
Oh, if only it had an opening theme song like in Jason Takes Manhattan. What is that monologue? The city that never sleeps. You got to get the fear pumping, good people.
All right. Well, in a way, we'll get the fear pumping a little bit because we're about to play for you the audio of the trailer. This was like, I think, an early trailer for it, but it's a really good one. It reminds us of the rules. And if I'm not mistaken, it has a voiceover by Don LaFontaine, the voice of God. So it's a good one.
Remember the last time? We told you not to feed them after midnight. We told you to keep them away from the light. And the most important warning of all, we told you to never, ever get them wet. You didn't listen.
You didn't listen. Here we are.
They're mutating.
Sir, is the building on fire?
No, no, that's a false alarm.
Are you trying to panic New York City?
Absolutely.
So the monsters are real?
I didn't say that.
Gremlins 2. The new batch.
Now, was that civilized?
No, clearly not. Fun, but in no sense civilized.
Now, real quick, if you've not seen Gremlins 2, or you want to see it again at this point, if you need a break and go watch it, well, lucky for you, this is a major release. You can get a copy of this in pretty much any format you desire. It's widely available. I ended up renting it on Blu-ray from Videodrome because I forgot that it was streaming on HBO Max. So if you're an HBO Max subscriber, as of this recording, you can go watch it there.
That's how I saw it.
Though I guess ideally, you need to watch it in a theater.
Yes.
That is about to be overtaken by gremlins, and you need to have Hulk Hogan in the audience with you.
Yeah. Did Hulk Hogan attend the premiere?
I don't know. This was a film that there was a lot to wrangle with this film. I didn't get a chance to look at the premiere photos. And I guess it's a good point to mention this as we go into some of the connections, the people of note involved here. This cast is immense. If you count not only the main cast, but all the cameos and the bit parts played by up-and-coming actors who'd later go on to be bigger names, there's so many people that we're going to not have time to mention, or I'm just going to have to mention briefly.
Yeah, the cast is enormous, especially including all the cameos. And even there are people who I think were not cameos at the time. They're just who were minor actors at the mm-hmm. time who later went on to have recognizable careers. Like when we were watching the cast scroll down the screen, I was just seeing like, what? Oh, minor part played by Isaiah Whitlock, who played a character on The Wire, or like, wait, is that Dean Norris?
Yeah, Dean Norris is like a SWAT team member, and I didn't notice him at all. Isaiah Whitlock Jr. is a fireman, and I didn't notice him at all. So yeah, there are names like that just sprinkled in there. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astaproallergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But okay, first we got to do the director. So G2 and G1, both Joe Dante.
That's right. Born 1946. And I don't know about you, but I always had a hard time classifying Joe Dante. You could say horror legend. Yeah, I think that's not incorrect. But he's also got more than a dash of that Spielbergian energy as well.
Mm-hmm.
He's also a man after my own heart. He has a great love for film trailers. See his long-running Trailers from Hell series. As a horror director, we can instantly look to such films as The Howling from 1981, which is, as I recall, a pretty stellar werewolf film. There's Piranha from 1978, and then I guess you could qualify Gremlins as a horror movie. Again, it's kind of all over the place with that one.
Yeah, Piranha in 78, that makes me wonder if Joe Dante had early association with the Corman camp.
There are a number of Corman connections to be made just in this film alone, yeah.
Okay, I can't confirm that, but I suspect it now.
He also directed the segment It's a Good Life in Twilight Zone, the movie from 1983. And yeah, on the other side of things, he did 1985's The Explorers, 1987's Inner Space, which I loved as a kid. I just haven't seen it in forever, but oh, I would build those little micro subs or my versions of them out of Legos.
Wait, is that the one where they shrink down and go inside a human body?
Not just any human body. It's Martin Short, right? They go inside. Okay. Martin Short is the human.
Which was, there was one, I think there were two different movies like that, weren't there? Like, in one of them was also the premise of a ride at Epcot Center. Am I wrong about that?
I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
But yeah, Inner Space is the one where I think you had Dennis Quaid as the guy inside the little submarine, and he goes into Martin Short's body and at times controls Martin Short's body. And then, there are a lot of antics ensue, but there's a lot of cool Fantastic Voyage type stuff happening inside the body there.
Oh yeah. Just looked it up. Interspace has a lot of cast overlap with G2. Mm-hmm. Got Dick Miller, got Picardo, got Henry Gibson. They're all showing up.
Picardo in that one plays the enemy agent who gets in his own tiny submarine. And Dennis Quaid and him have this battle inside of like Martin Short's stomach or something.
Awesome.
And so Martin Short's like, you know, physically ill while these two are fighting to the death inside of his stomach acid. It's wonderful.
Nice. Okay, wait, but back to Dante.
Yeah, yeah. So on top of that, there's 1989's The Burbs, 1993's Matinee, all fun films. But outside of the horror box, by and large, I guess The Burbs has horror elements, though. On top of that, he also did some TV work, including directing episodes of Police Squad with Leslie Nielsen.
Mm.
So I think if you take all of that in, Gremlins 2 is kind of an interesting amalgam of these apparent interests and cinematic values, because while less tonally inconsistent, it does still manage to deliver some scares, some goofy stuff, some creepy stuff. It definitely wears its love for genre cinema on its sleeve with numerous references to various films. It tries its hand at some very broad parody. And above all, it's fun. It focuses on the fun. Now, on the writing side of things, the original Gremlins was written by Christopher Columbus, of all people, though I believe he was like maybe the fourth person to write that script and was just the only name that retained credit.
Christopher Columbus, like the Home Alone guy?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this one, however, is the work of Charles S. Haas, born 1952, who wrote the 1979 teen rebel movie Over the Edge, did uncredited work on the Tron screenplay, as well as 1989's Martians Go Home and Dante's Matinee.
I think a lot of this movie, though, I mean, I don't know because I'm not looking at the script right now, but I imagine a lot of stuff in it is just concept work more than like writing out a scene with dialogue. Like, what if we showed this here and then we transitioned to that and then we had somebody just improv and so forth.
Though it would be an interesting experiment to see someone write the script for Gremlins 2 as if everything in the movie is on the page.
Yeah.
It's a good one for like really mean-spirited screenplay writing teachers.
That would be great.
Okay, now normally we don't talk about special effects till later, but we have to mention that the special effects supervisor and co-producer credit on this is the legendary Rick Baker.
Special effects are front and center in Gremlins 2, and they are phenomenal.
Yeah. When you think about Rick Baker, and I recommend you do, he has a great Instagram, by the way, definitely worth following. He's directed so many monster movies and also a lot of non-monster movies, and it's easy to focus on things like An American Werewolf in London or Videodrome, or to go in a different direction, Gorillas in the Mist. But I have to say, Baker and his team just absolutely knock it out of the park with Gremlins 2. You go back and you look at the original Gremlins, and the creatures have character, but they're very rough around the edges. There's a very much, there's still kind of a feeling of throw a puppet across the room kind of a thing, you know?
Yeah.
Gremlins 2 is a huge leap forward in puppetry and special effects, giving us just a whole mob of convincing gremlins, each with their own character. And Gizmo himself in this is just a living creature. I mean, Gizmo alone is a masterstroke in this film. He's as real as he is adorable, and he is so adorable every moment he's on screen. The cute could not be cranked up any higher. It's just like supernatural. I mean, it's like supernatural, but also super normal stimuli. The close-ups especially. Like, anytime Gizmo's on the screen, you just can't help but squirm at just how adorable he is.
I had the exact same reaction. The puppets in this movie are alive. You could not tell me those are not real living gremlins.
Yeah, they're just so good. And of course, with the gremlins proper, they're so gross. There's so many gross scenes with the gremlins.
There's some real slime.
But then also there are lots of fun, very cartoony effects. And on the subject of cartoons, worth pointing out that animation legend Chuck Jones did the opening and closing animation sequences for this that feature, although the opening has Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck in it, and at the end we have Porky Pig as well.
And no gremlins. The opening animation is just an unrelated Bugs Bunny cartoon.
Yeah.
But I think that sets the tone appropriately because it's just chaos.
Absolutely. And if your intro, it's like they're saying, this is going to be a cartoon. Just bear that in mind as we continue.
All right, so you want to try to do some of the cast?
Yeah, I'm not going to get into the very small parts. If they come up later in discussion, we'll reference them. But yeah, there are a lot of people I'm not going to reference. Let's just start with our main human cast. Human characters who have some degree of character and, I don't know, an arc, if you will. Mm-hmm. But at the top, we have Billy and Kate. Billy is played by Zach Galligan. Born 1964. This is our small town kid from the first movie, now living and working in the Big Apple. He's probably best known for his role in the Gremlins movies, but he was also in 1988's Waxwork, its 1992 sequel. He's in 1992's Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth, which in a weird way is almost the Gremlins 2 of the Hellraiser movies, but falls short of actually like pulling that off.
No, you can imagine the Key and Peele sketch style script meeting for Hellraiser 3. Yeah. It's like, what about CD Cinnabite? Yeah.
It's in the movie.
Yeah.
But he's also in the 1993's Warlock, The Armageddon. He's in the Strung Along episode of Tales from the Crypt. This is one of at least a couple of Twisted Puppeteer episodes. This is the one that starred Donald O'Connor. So that's Billy. But then Kate is played by Phoebe Cates, born 1963. This is Billy's girlfriend from the first movie. She's moved to New York City with him, and she also works at the same high-rise building. Mm-hmm. Other films of note include 1982's Fast Times at Ridgemont High, 83's Private School, oh, and also 1991's Drop Dead Fred, in which Rick Mayall plays her imaginary friend in a movie directed by Ate de Jong, who also did Highway to Hell, which we covered on the show previously. I don't think she's active as an actor anymore. I could be mistaken on that, but I think she like runs a New York City boutique, and she's been married to the actor Kevin Kline since 1989.
Very, very charming lead couple in both of these movies. It is hard not to like Zach and Phoebe in these roles.
Absolutely. Now, we also have a character in this film by the name of Daniel Clamp, played by John Glover. Born 1944. So first of all, let's just focus on the fact that this is the actor John Glover. John Glover is an incredible character actor. He's got this like handsome, charming, impish vibe to him. He plays the mental institution front desk guy in John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness.
I was going to say he's kind of evil Hugh Grant, but actually I think Hugh Grant is evil John Glover.
Yeah, like there's, even as he plays a lot of villains, but he brings a certain charm to them. Not only sinister villains, but also he especially earlier in his career, he was able to play sort of preppy villains as well. I don't remember this character entirely, but he played Bruce Cummings in 1988 Scrooged.
I've seen Scrooge, but I don't remember who that is.
I think this is just like the foil to Bill Murray. Like, this is some guy Bill Murray's character doesn't like.
Okay.
Which I guess is kind of a trope character in and of itself. I think he also played the sinister bomb maker in the 1999 revenge film Payback, and he's done a lot of voice work as well. He voiced the Riddler on Batman the Animated Series.
Oh, I love Batman the Animated Series. Got a lot of great voice work on that.
Indeed. His TV credits are just all over the place. He's been in everything from Tales from the Crypt to Murder, She Wrote. He also has, he's had some interesting bit parts over the years. He plays an ex-boyfriend in Annie Hall and has a weird scene in that. And he's the Magnavolt salesman in RoboCop 2.
RoboCop 2 is another movie that in a less child-friendly way has some Gremlins 2 type energy.
I think so. Yeah. That's another one that I enjoy.
Okay. But wait a minute. We've got some stuff going on with this character because so this is a kind of, I don't know, you might say he's sort of set up as a villain of the movie, but then doesn't really become one. His name is Daniel Clamp, and he plays a sort of fame-hungry real estate developer in New York who owns a famous tower.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of Ted Turner to the character in that he also runs a cable channel, a network or something, but... Yeah, the Donald Trump parody vibes are extremely overt with this. It's impossible to ignore. Mm-hmm. However, this isn't nearly as distracting as you might think. If you haven't seen this movie before, or you perhaps haven't seen it since you were a kid, it's not like Donald Trump actually showing up in Home Alone 2. And I think part of this is that John Glover, of course, is just so good and has sort of a natural charm to him. And he doesn't do a straightforward impersonation. He's not doing an impersonation of this real life individual. The character of Daniel Clamp goes off and kind of has its own dimensions. So yeah, he's greedy, he's obsessed with his own image, but he's not the outright villain of the picture. And based on a couple of different interviews I read, one from 1990, one from 2016. Oh, and there was also a 1990 Fresh Air with Terry Gross interview with Glover where he talks about Gremlins 2. Based on all of this, it seems like maybe he was going to be more of a villain at some point in the development of the script, but they pulled back on it for a few different reasons. And so the final product feels distinct and a little like it's definitely a parody of Trump, but it's not Trump. And therefore, I didn't find it nearly as distracting as I kind of expected it to. You know, like it doesn't force me to think about politics all that much whilst watching a Gremlins movie.
Yeah, it's also... So it's clearly the character is based on Donald Trump in terms of situation. Like he is a fame hungry Manhattan real estate developer who owns the high rise tower where the movie is set.
And yet it doesn't seem to be strongly based on Trump's real personality. And the way Glover plays it is an interesting choice. You can almost feel the actor's role in diverting the character from its original trajectory because of how much fun he's obviously having with it. Mm-hmm. I think like elements of that raw, ravenous greed and the, you know, the narcissistic nastiness still peek through. But Glover has transformed the character into something very different, like more of an exuberant, oblivious man-child who is just so excited about being a billionaire. And he's thrilled at all the fun stuff that he gets to do because he's a billionaire. I think the original, more strictly Trump-like, more overtly villainous version of this character would have worked, but it also would have been more familiar, more like the, you know, like the villains we see in RoboCop and a bunch of other movies from the period, which are great, by the way. I mean, I love Dick Jones. I love all the OCP suits in RoboCop. But Glover's Daniel Clamp becomes something different, kind of fresher and weirder. He plays this character like a simple-minded man who is surprised to find himself so rich and powerful and famous and just jazzed about it every day.
Yeah, I think that sums it up. So it's a fun performance. He has a lot of screen time and hangs around longer than you'd think. Like in another version of Gremlins 2, he would have been eaten by a gremlin about halfway through or something, or, you know, launched out of a cannon or something. But but that's not how it goes down. All right, let's see. Other actors of note here. These are kind of supporting characters. I'll try and move more quickly through these. We have a character named Grandpa Fred who pops up. And honestly, up until this week, I thought this was actually Grandpa Munster, a.k.a. Real name Al Lewis, because that's essentially what the character is. It's Grandpa Munster. He's a late-night horror TV host. But it's not Al Lewis. It's Robert Prosky, who lived 1930 through 2008, known for such films as Michael Mann's Thief, as well as Michael Mann's The Keep, 87th Broadcast News, Mrs. Doubtfire, and Dead Man Walking.
It took me a minute to figure out where I recognized him most from, and I realized it was from the fantasy action film The Last Action Hero, where Robert Prosky plays the film projectionist who gives the kid in the movie the magic movie ticket that allows him to enter the world of films.
Okay. All right, let's see, another character. Okay, this character is basically Clamp's right-hand man, his kind of like fixer and facilities manager. It's the character Forster, played by Robert Picardo, born 1953, a frequent Dante casting choice. A lot of TV viewers are probably familiar with him from such shows as, or at least older TV viewers, from The Wonder Years, China Beach, Star Trek Voyager, and also Stargate. But he was also in the films The Howling. He was in the 1987 Gromlins movie, Munchies, 87's Inner Space. Oh, he's Johnny Cab in 1990's Total Recall.
I didn't realize that was him.
I didn't either, but he's credited as being the voice and the inspiration for the likeness.
Oh, now I can hear it as soon as you said that. The door opened, you got in.
I didn't even realize this either, but in Ridley Scott's 1985 film, Legend, he plays Meg Mucklebones.
Huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Wouldn't have recognized him there either.
No, I mean, I wouldn't recognize anybody. You could put anybody in the Meg Mucklebones makeup and they would be unrecognizable. But anyway, he's been in a ton of stuff. He was also in 2016's Hail Caesar from the Coen brothers. Okay. In terms of villainous actors, though, we, of course, have to point out that Christopher Lee is in this.
Oh, Christopher Lee is great in this. He plays a character named Dr. Cushing Catheter.
Yep, Dr. Catheter.
And I think also, obviously, the first name is a Peter Cushing reference.
Oh, of course it is. Yeah, that one flew right past me. But he plays the head of the genetic manipulation lab that is renting office space in the Clamp Tower or whatever it's called here. And yeah, he seems like he's having a really good time hamming it up as this essentially a mad scientist. And it was fun watching with my, I watched this with my son. And when Christopher Lee showed up, he was like, "Hey, it's Dooku." And indeed it is Dooku.
I love how when we very first meet him, he's going through packages he received in the mail, hoping they're various kinds of disease samples. He's like, I want anthrax, and they give me the flu.
All right, another bit role. This is a character that shows up seeming more like an extra, but has like a slightly bigger role as it progresses. We have Gedi Watanabe playing a character that I believe is credited as Mr. Katsuji. But essentially what we have here is he plays a stereotype of an Asian tourist, mm-hmm. a man that we see going around with a whole bunch of cameras, just taking photographs nonstop, and eventually gets roped into filming for the grandpa character, our horror host character. And I guess there is a fun scene there where he says, hey, do you know how to work a camera? And he says, I am a camera. And then they go off.
I don't know why people thought this was so funny. There are so many movies from the 80s that have the stereotype of the Japanese tourist who won't stop taking pictures of everything. It's a really annoying cliche, but at the same time, Gedi Watanabe is an immensely likable guy, despite the fact that he's unfortunately cast in these stereotypical roles throughout the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, he's still acting today, and his roles have certainly matured a whole lot. But he was this particular role is reminiscent of some of the offensively stereotypical roles that he played during the 1980s, most notably his role in 16 Candles. But he pops up in other films, like he's in the otherwise stylish but also problematic in other ways Grace Jones film Vamp. He has this very stereotypical and offensive character in that as well. He was also in the Weird Al movie UHF, but I don't really remember who he played in that.
I do not remember either, but UHF, also a very chaotic, fun movie.
Now, another character that returns from the previous Gremlins film, at least in a very small role at the beginning, is the character of Mr. Wing, played by Key Luke, who lived 1904 through 1991.
Oh, he's come up on the show before.
Yeah, he was a Chinese-American actor who was in a ton of films from the classic era, including Mad Love in 1935. So if you go back to our Mad Love episode, we reference him on that because he plays this kind of a background character, but he plays this character, Dr. Wong. Now, naturally, given the time during which he was active, many of his roles also conformed to Chinese stereotypes and stereotypes of Chinese Americans at the time, but you know, still a rather groundbreaking figure and a founding member of the Screen Actors Guild.
I think I read something about how in the Gremlins movies, he's supposed to play an old man who runs this curiosity shop that sells the Mogwai to Hoyt Axton. Whatever, the father figure in the first movie. Mm-hmm. And I think what I read was that he is supposed to be an old man, and despite actually being quite old when they filmed the movie, they had to put him in makeup to make him look older because he just looked too youthful when he got old.
Yeah, I mean, Hoyt Axton was no spring chicken.
I guess, Key Luke really took care of himself.
I mean, he's eating right, he's living with a Mogwai. Well, I mean, that's the character.
A Mogwai, I would imagine, as long as it doesn't get wet and make the transition, a Mogwai really adds years to your life.
If you got to have a good, well, I don't know. Well, this is a big question regarding Gizmo, because Gizmo is good. Gizmo is a little too curious for his own good. Everything that happens in G2 could have been avoided if Gizmo could have just remained in a drawer for 2 hours. But still, he's very likable. He has a great demeanor. But the instant he reproduces via water splash, all of his offspring are chaotic and or nasty. So one wonders is this like the sign of a mature Mogwai that has been able to devote his life or its life to the pursuit of order and calmness and a quiet life of recollection and reflection, or is this just an anomaly?
Yeah, why is Gizmo unlike the others? That's a great question.
Yeah. This film will not answer that question.
No.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics, in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Maybe we should talk about how exactly it works in case you've never seen either of these movies. So the gremlin progression is Gizmo is the original gremlin. Gizmo is, he's a creature called a Mogwai. He's a fuzzy, cute, adorable, good-natured little critter. He's got, just the adorable eyes, and he's great. But if you get him wet, things pop off of his back, and they shoot all over the place, and they turn into also still fuzzy but mean-spirited little creatures. And then if the fuzzy but mean-spirited little creatures eat after midnight, then they turn into green, scaly, slimy, murderous creatures.
Yeah. Like a question that might arise is, well, what would happen if Gizmo were to eat after midnight? Now, here's the thing. Gizmo would never eat after midnight. Gizmo is a good boy. He would never do that. And I don't know that we would want to explore what would happen in a film if he did. But if he did, would he be a good gremlin? It seems like maybe he would.
Maybe it would turn him into like a beefed up good gremlin. So he could be like the scaly, big, brawny gremlin who can fight the other scaly gremlins because he's on the side of good.
I would allow it in a picture so long as he got to change back into cute Mogwai Gizmo at the end. You can't have Gizmo permanently changing into a scaly gremlin. That's just not good for business.
Okay, we're barely into the cast. We've got to pick up the pace somehow.
Okay, all right. We have a character named Marla Bloodstone, played by Haviland Morris, born 1959, an ambitious, chain-smoking, scarlet-haired workplace vixen, a really fun, over-the-top character. This actor played Caroline in 1984's 16 Candles. She was also in the 1987 Madonna vehicle, Who's That Girl? Who was that girl? Well, it was Madonna. And then a whole lot of TV work over the years, including one episode of Tales from the Dark Side. It's an extremely over-the-top performance, but in Gremlins 2, it works perfectly.
She plays Zach Galligan's boss who is sexually harassing him. Yes. And she's great in this role. And she there's one really great moment at the end where they're all like putting together a plan to defeat the gremlins, and they're giving tasks to different people. And I think they say to Haviland Morris, they're just like, "You smoke cigarettes." And she goes, "Okay, got it."
Now, this already sounds like enough human characters for a movie that's mostly about gremlins, but no, the Futtermans are coming to town as well.
They're from the first movie.
I don't remember them at all. I had to be reminded. But yeah, Dick Miller plays Murray Futterman, and Jackie Joseph plays Shelia Futterman. And yeah, they're here to visit our main characters. They just kind of seem to show up unannounced right in the midst of all this gremlin mischief.
How many movies have we talked about that had Dick Miller in them? I can definitely think of two, both Corman associated. He was in Chopping Mall as the janitor, and he was the vacuum salesman in Not of This Earth.
Oh, he was in the Tales from the Crypt movie as well. The good one. Demon Knight. He was in Demon Knight.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Dick Miller, one of our favorite character actors. He livens up everything he appears in. Even he's one of those actors, I think you give him a bit part where all he's supposed to do is, you know, be a janitor and say like, "Oh, I got to clean these floors. I hate my job." And he breathes life into that grumpy role.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's pretty much what he did in Chopping Mall, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, in this, he's fun. He gets to beat up on some gremlins. Yeah, Dick Miller's always great on the screen. Oh, but Jackie Joseph, who plays his wife in this, born 1933, she was a regular on the Doris Day Show in the early 70s, and she was in 1960's The Little Shop of Horrors. All right, just a couple more before we move out of the humans here. But we also have a pair of identical twins, Don and Dan Stanton, playing Martin and Lewis. They were both born in 1952, obviously. Identical twin actors who play these. Yeah, it's like a Tweedledum and Tweedledee sort of thing, except they're scientists working for Dr. Catheter. These guys were never in a ton of stuff, but they have a memorable scene in Terminator 2.
Oh, they play the cop who gets eye spiked by the T-1000 in the mental institution. Remember?
Yes.
The T-1000, I guess, he morphs up out of the floor and becomes one of them and then spikes the other one.
Yeah, that's a scene where I never looked into it. I always thought it was just special effects magic. Turns out it was twin magic.
Hiring twins, probably cheaper than doing special effects.
Yeah. Oh, now this one's borderline cameo or small part, but Julia Sweeney plays Peggy, the receptionist for Dr. Catheter, born 1959, American actor and comedian, probably best known for her stint on Saturday Night Live from 1990 through 1994.
The joke being that Dr. Catheter is receiving all these diseases in the mail, and she's sitting there at the reception desk, like constantly sneezing and coughing. And at one point he's like, "May I have that tissue?"
Yes. All right. So there are more humans. We may reference more humans, but those are some of the main ones. Real quick, voice acting for Gremlins and Mogwai. Gizmo is voiced by Howie Mandel.
Okay.
Howie Mandel, born 1955. This may be Howie Mandel's finest work, and it's perfect. Like, the voice is just perfect. Gizmo doesn't say much, but what he does say totally resonates and feels cute. Mandel, of course, is a Canadian-American actor and comedian. He played a sea monkey dad on The Amazing Life, Live Sea Monkeys from 1992, and was the creator, producer, and lead voice actor on the cartoon Bobby's World from 1990 through 1998.
Now, one thing this movie has that the previous movie does not have, there are a lot of things like that, but one really notable one is a talking, full gremlified gremlin.
Yeah, a gremlin that injects itself with brain serum, like super smart serum that's, you know, very clearly labeled from the genetic splicing lab that Dr. Catheter handles. And yeah, once this serum takes effect, well, now he can talk. He's very intellectual. And of course, he wears like a tweed jacket, puts on some spectacles, and smokes a pipe.
And his voice, as far as I could tell, is supposed to be a posh Australian accent. I was a little confused there.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to nail down, but he was voiced by Tony Randall, who lived 1920 through 2004. Legendary American actor, probably best known for his role as Felix Unger in the television adaptation of the 1965 play The Odd Couple by Neil Simon. But this is a guy that acted in film, on TV, on Broadway, and here he is in G2.
Now, you'd be shocked if Frank Welker didn't show up.
Yeah, Frank Welker, of course, shows up. He's the voice of Mohawk, Gremlin. I'm not sure which gremlin this was. The gremlin that kind of looks like the gremlin, the bad, super bad gremlin from the first movie. But I don't remember what happens to this one. If he's the one, is this the one that winds up in the paper
spider? Oh, I was thinking maybe this is the spider one, but maybe he's the shredder one. I don't know.
Could be. It becomes, yeah, it's easy to lose track of the pre-mutation gremlins. And not all the gremlins mutate. There's one that just starts smoking a cigar, and that's his thing for the rest of the picture. There's another one that gets his face burnt by acid, acid that's clearly labeled do not throw in face.
Yes.
One of the other gremlins throws the acid in his face, and then he grabs a Phantom of the Opera mask and starts running around as the Phantom of the Opera.
He plays the organ.
Yeah. So not an actual genetic mutation, but the gremlins in this movie are quick to latch on to an identity. All right, so there are a lot of cameos. I don't know. Do you want to mention any of these cameos that you were particularly taken with, or do you want to wait and see if they come up organically?
Let's see. Oh, well, I did have a note on Henry Gibson, which I thought was a funny choice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Henry Gibson pops up as an employee who's fired for smoking via, a security camera.
Yeah, I think this is to show off the tower where the movie takes place, their surveillance, and Henry Gibson is taking a smoke break, and they zoom in on his face, and they're like, employee number 575, whatever, you are fired for taking a break. And this is Henry Gibson, who did many things. Most notable to me is that he appears in Robert Altman's excellent ambient drama Nashville from 75, playing Haven Hamilton, sort of the old guard of the Nashville country music machine, wearing a nudie suit. There's a great scene where he's recording a patriotic song about America for the bicentennial that has the chorus, "We must be doing something right to last 200 years.
Oh, yeah. You know, I've never actually seen Nashville.
Oh.
I'm familiar with it for its, it's a legendary picture for its music and its approach to music and all, but great cast. I probably knew Henry Gibson best from Joe Dante's 1989 film, The Burbs, in which he's one of Tom Hanks' many weird neighbors, which also includes one of the other weird neighbors in that film is Brother Theodore.
Hmm. Oh, what was the movie we saw with Brother Theodore? It was like preaching on the street or something?
That was the film starring Warhawk Tanzania.
Oh, yes. The speech about how God is dead and the rats are screaming.
Yes, yes. Devil's Express.
Yeah.
Yeah. From 1976, starring Warhawk Tanzania. You know, just your average New York martial arts picture about a demon from across the ocean that takes up in the New York City subway system.
Okay. Do we have to throw in the towel on cameos, though? Because we end up mentioning a lot.
Yeah, there are a lot of great ones. If they come up later in the discussion organically, I'll reference them. Otherwise, write in with your favorite, and maybe we can talk about it on Listener Mail.
Okay, so as far as plot breakdown goes, I'm going to say Gremlins 2 is actually somewhat light on plot, which is to say the action of the film is not tightly logical. It is more a movie about creating situations or premises and then exploiting those for just lots of random bits of spectacle and gags. It's kind of a variety show. So what are those premises? Well, I'd say mainly it is a parody of modern city life as seen in 1990, especially business culture, technology, media, and capitalism. And this is all wrapped up into one very convenient setting, the Clamp Premier Regency Trade Center and Retail Concourse, a sort of cross between Trump Tower, the CNN Center, the Starship Enterprise, and the building from Chopping Mall.
Yeah, there is kind of a chopping mall kind of a vibe to it.
So it's supposed to be this computerized marvel full of high-tech upgrades, such as automatic revolving doors, which are a miracle of efficiency, as a voiceover informs us while we watch people getting stuck in them and unable to get out. In fact, it's a joke recurring throughout the movie that nobody can get through the automatic revolving doors and they have to just go around to the other doors.
Yeah, even the SWAT team can't figure it out when they show up at the end of the picture.
Yeah. And also every inch of the building is under surveillance with cameras and computers that have sensors on everything. But it's also the site of many horrible businesses, including the soulless real estate development firm where Billy works at the beginning of the movie. He's, I think, supposed to be some kind of illustrator or designer. And this is Daniel Clamp's personal business. It's the business that he's going to use to, you know, destroy historic landmarks and replace them with god-awful monstrosities. But the tower also includes television studios for airing things like, of course, there's news, but there's like a cooking show that primarily uses the microwave and an Elvira-style hosted horror rerun program, as you mentioned earlier, the one that Grandpa Fred is doing dressed as Grandpa Munster. But, of course, Grandpa Fred complains that he can't show the classic monster movies he wants to show because Mr. Clamp, who owns the network, does not like anything in black and white, only color films.
There's a fun bit of voiceover in the background, like the PA system, announcing how they're going to be showing Casablanca on the network, now in full beautiful color.
Oh. And then, of course, there is the genetics lab run by Christopher Lee as Dr. Cushing Catheter. I think it's called Splice of Life, and it specializes in unholy, unethical experiments along with the Stanton twins there. Like when we first go in, of course, Christopher Lee is receiving all his germs in the mail, and then we just see all kinds of stuff going on. They're like walking a cow around the room with that like a mind control helmet on, and it's saying, "I like giving milk."
Yeah.
And then there is a frozen yogurt restaurant, which seems unremarkable to me, but I think this is supposed to be something the filmmakers thought was ridiculous and funny. Okay, but anyway, you got that whole situation. The gremlins are unleashed upon this situation, and what follows is a lot of disconnected, chaotic set pieces. But in the setup to that plot, let's see, we got a few things that happened to sort of let us know what's going on. One of the first things is that Robert Picardo, as Daniel Clamp's fixer, visits the curiosity shop, the antique store from the first movie, and meets Key Luke. And he's like, "Hey, you know, I'm here at your shop. I'm representing Daniel Clamp. He wants you to sell your business so that we can tear it down and replace all of the historic, you know, businesses and everything in Chinatown with this monstrosity, this big, ugly building that's going to reach to the clouds." And Key Luke is not interested, but he seems to be a sick old man. And Robert Picardo's just like, "We just have to wait him out. He'll die soon." And meanwhile, we see Gizmo watching Rambo on TV.
Yeah, because they leave the television set that Clamp uses to send his message and make his offer. And then they're just like, "You can keep the TV." And so Gizmo like reaches out of his little cage and he gets the remote. It's the first of many adorable moments with Gizmo.
Yeah, he's watching Sylvester Stallone being like, to win a war, you got to become war. And later, Gizmo will become war.
It's true.
And so, unfortunately, the old man eventually dies, and then we see a very sad, lonely Gizmo, and then the building is destroyed. There's like a wrecking ball knocking it up. So as the antique shop is knocked down, Gizmo escapes, only to be captured in the alley by one of the Stanton twins, the weird ginger twins who work in the genetics lab.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, we meet Zach Galligan and Phoebe Cates, reprising the roles from the first film, as we said, as Billy and Kate. They're living in the city now. They're working in the Clamp Tower. We get that first. I laughed out loud at the first time we saw the revolving door not working while the voiceover is telling us what a miracle of efficiency it is. And it turns out so that Zach Galligan is working for this real estate development business owned by Daniel Clamp, the one that's demolishing Chinatown. His boss, again, is Marla Bloodstone. Make of that what you will, by the way, with the name. I think with Bloodstone, they're like going for can't get blood from a stone. With Marla, the film creators claim that the name is a complete coincidence. It was before there was public knowledge of Marla Maples. So they say that's just serendipity.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about the Marla Maples thing. I still don't actually know what all this is about, but I did see it referenced in that, I think, that Terry Gross interview with Glover, where he was like, "Oh yeah, we didn't know about any of that when we made this. It's just coincidence."
Well, anyway, she's like, you know, smoking cigarettes in the office. There's a great part where we see that Billy has been drawing, and I think Robert Picardo comes through to be like offended that Billy has been drawing, and he's like, "How dare you, muddy up this office with your art? We have paid millions of dollars to have legitimate art displayed on the walls," and he points to some kind of stupid looking abstract painting.
Yeah, yeah, and also he's offended that he has a potted plant.
It's yes,
like, no, you can't. This is an infestation, which of course is nice. nice allusion to what's coming ahead. You know, there's going to be a real infestation occurring later in the picture.
Yeah, so Billy's working up there. Meanwhile, Kate is working as a tour guide for the Clamp building, which looks like a horrible job. She leads tours around and have to go like hawking copies of the Art of the Clamp. And it's you feel for Kate. It she has to wear this really stupid looking hat.
Mm-hmm.
So the setup of the film is that the Stanton twins bring Gizmo into the lab of Dr. Cushing Catheter, again portrayed by Christopher Lee, and they're studying the fact that he can dance to rock and roll music.
Oh, it's such a great sequence. I watched this scene twice. It was it's so cute. It's adorable. Like, there's so much going on here because Christopher Lee's character is sort of scowling at the whole affair. Gizmo comes out and begins to dance. And his dance is very cute. It's a special effects showcase because it looks totally believable. Meanwhile, the Stanton twins, they're also dancing a little bit in the background. So much fun.
Yeah, they're rocking in sync with each other in an almost uncanny way, I would say, with them. But yeah, we also learn about a bunch of their other experiments. Like, this lab is just creating kind of DNA juices of various flavors. They're like, here's a DNA juice that will turn a rat into a battery so you can power in a light bulb by touching it to the rat. And, oh no, will a gremlin drink that later and become electricity gremlin? I wonder.
Yeah. Electricity gremlin, who's more of an important part of this film than you could possibly imagine.
Yes, and many other things like that. There's just various animals in cages, assuming we're getting juice out of them to create DNA juice that would turn whatever drinks it into a bat or into vegetables or whatever. So eventually, Billy becomes aware that Gizmo is in the building because he hears a delivery man singing Gizmo's distinctive little song. He's like, "Where did you hear that?" And it's, you know, down in the lab. So Billy sneaks down to rescue Gizmo. He takes him, he hides him in his office file cabinet, and there's a very, like, comedic high-tension scene where Daniel Clamp comes for an office visit, and he's like, "Why does your drawer keep popping open and babbling in a cute little voice?" So Gizmo is almost discovered, but not. But Billy cannot take Gizmo home because his boss, Marla Bloodstone, insists that he go out to dinner with her to one of my favorite set pieces in the whole movie. They go to a Canadian Mountie-themed restaurant.
Mm-hmm. I found this especially funny because when my family went to Epcot in the last year or so, they have a Canadian themed restaurant there. Like, it's a Canadian steak restaurant you can go to. And they actually have some nice vegetarian and vegan options there, by the way. But it is totally, it's like Canadian themed. It's not like the first thing I would think of, like a restaurant experience I want to have, but it was really nice. But there were no Mounties. There were no, like, all the decorating elements in this scene are just amazing and pitch perfect. Like a giant moose head, those big ridiculous mugs they have.
And no offense to Canada. In fact, I'm a pretty big fan of Canada. I don't usually think of them being known for their cuisine.
Well, you've got the
poutine, I guess.
The poutine, yeah, yeah. And Molson. They're drinking Molson.
That's right. You want another Molson? Yeah. but yeah, so the Mountie-themed restaurant is great. Billy sends Kate back to pick up Gizmo, but before she can get there, one of the rules gets broken.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When your child fights sleep, it can feel like a battle you'll never win. Imagine a bedtime routine you all look forward to, where you cuddle in and let the stress of the day melt away. Welcome to Sleep Tight Stories, a calming weekly podcast that brings bedtime stories, cuddles, and comfort to families worldwide. The stories are quirky, relatable, and spark wonder without overstimulation, so listeners can fall asleep and stay asleep. Each episode is narrated by me, Cheryl McLeod, a second grade teacher, and written by my husband, Clark, an eternal second grader at heart. Tune in tonight and bond over a story before drifting off to sleep. Make bedtime the sweetest part of your day. Sleep Tight Stories. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Got to break the rules for the movie to get cranking. A maintenance man comes along. He tries to repair a water fountain, and it accidentally squirts some water on Gizmo. So Gizmo starts popping off. Here come the fuzzy bad guys popping out of his back. And how are they ever going to eat after midnight and turn into green, slimy, spiky boys? Well, they're in Clamp Tower. There is plenty of food to be found.
That's John Astin, by the way, the original Gomez from the Addams Family as the maintenance guy who messes up the water fountain.
So Phoebe Cates accidentally brings home one of the wrong gremlins, the googly-eyed gremlin of Key and Peele sketch fame.
This gremlin is ridiculous. Like I don't know what you call this laugh. It's very similar to the laugh that Christopher Lloyd's character in Who Framed Roger Rabbit uses. It's this kind of like just unhinged cartoon cackling.
Well, also, I think one of the weasels in that movie that can't stop laughing.
Oh, yeah. I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And it's nonstop. All the googly-eyed gremlin wants to do is eat some food, but mostly throw food and make a mess.
He loves to make a mess. So Billy comes home, finds the googly-eyed gremlin. He's like, uh-oh, this is not Gizmo. Something has gone horribly wrong. And then the movie is just off to the races. I don't think we can describe scene by scene from here on, but maybe we can just focus on some of the subplots. Like, okay, so what do we have to say about, of course, the gremlins are going to get into Splice of Life, the genetics lab.
Yeah.
So one of them drinks the electricity juice and becomes electricity gremlin. One drinks something. I think they were trying to, there's a scene where they're trying to create more durable tomatoes, and they show them like bouncing off a wall, and they say, oh wow, they are durable, but how do they taste? And the guy goes, well, great news, our contract is with the airline food provider. So it's a joke. It doesn't matter how they taste. But a gremlin drinks that and turns into vegetables, I guess.
Yeah, he's like, he just kind of has vegetables growing out of him, and his like body is vegetables. We mentioned Brainy Gremlin, Spider Gremlin comes online as well. Mm-hmm. Bat Gremlin.
Gremlin leaves the Batman hole in the wall, and then later flies out on the street, attacks Dick Miller,
gets thrown into wet cement and then flies up on top of a church and sits down and becomes a gargoyle.
Yes. Yeah. Like each of these gremlins too is just amazing. Like Bat Gremlin is an incredible looking creature. He like ultimately ends up being like six-limbed gremlin because he has the flight arms and like little dinosaur arms and then his legs as well. Just again, fabulous job on all the effects here.
There's Lady Gremlin. Your thoughts on Lady Gremlin, Rob?
Lady Gremlin is very much in the tradition of like Bugs Bunny wearing a dress.
Yes.
But is potentially problematic, I guess, today. I don't think you would necessarily do this today in your Gremlins movie. She, of course, she ends up surviving.
Yes, she falls in love with Robert Picardo.
And they're married at the end.
Like they're married, movie, yes.
This movie ends in a marriage between a human and a gremlin. So I think that speaks volumes about the tone of the film. But let's see, there have to be some other mutated gremlins. Again, there are plenty of gremlins who take on their own identity. Like there's cigar-smoking gremlin.
Yes.
There's Phantom of the Opera gremlin. There's also like some just take on fashion choices. Like there's a gremlin that wears a witch hat. There's a gremlin that seems to design and produce his own anti-Gizmo t-shirt. You see him hanging in the background.
Oh.
It has a picture of Gizmo on it with a circle and a strike through it.
I didn't notice
you're like,
that.
Wow.
They are mean to Gizmo, yeah.
Yeah, they know who Gizmo is and they hate him.
Yeah, there are a couple of gremlins. One just has kind of like an overbite, kind of a donkey face.
Yeah, he's kind of, he's not as googly-eyed as the googly-eyed gremlin, but he's also like a little bit goofy. And he just kind of helps out. He's kind of like a stoogey gremlin.
Yes. The cigar-smoking gremlin and him are kind of a pair, aren't they?
Yeah, they are a pair. And yeah, they never get mutated. I don't know what they would have mutated into necessarily.
Like I remember a scene where they attack the film studio while they're shooting a live episode of the cooking show Microwaving with Marge. Mm-hmm. And the havoc they cause is they throw metal utensils into the microwave and then get it going so that it explodes and starts a fire.
Yes. Yeah, they do. They do that. Yes. I don't know. There's so many questions one could ask about this film. Like for instance, when they realize googly eyed Mogwai is not Gizmo, they just stick him in a bag to bring them back to the office with them. What was their plan? It seems like they know what gremlins are all about. They know the dangers of having too many Mogwai. In a less family friendly film, it seems like they might want to euthanize the Mogwai right there in the apartment.
I think this is a gremlin problem. Gremlin control conundrum. I don't think you can with good conscience kill the fuzzy gremlins, even though they're the bad ones. You have to wait for them to turn into the scaly evil gremlins, and then you can kill them.
Yeah, you got to give them at least a shot at not eating past midnight. Though clearly, this guy's going to eat past midnight. He's been eating and throwing food nonstop.
Now, there's another subplot with Grandpa Fred, the horror host, which is that he has always wanted to be a newscaster, which why? I mean, if you get to host a horror show, why would you be like, I really wish instead I was doing like the local news? That just seems like a trade down in every possible way.
Yeah, but he gets to live his dreams. He gets to like broadcast live from the depths of the gremlin nightmare. And these are fun segments as well. This is definitely in the last half of the film where everything just gets exceedingly weird and crazy.
Oh, we haven't discussed the Daniel Clamp subplot. So there's a subplot where he gets attacked by a gremlin in his office, which he manages to throw into the paper shredder because, there's a thing, it goes by quick, you might miss it, where his secretary informs him that his mail has arrived and she's shredding it now. Would he like her to shred anything else?
Yeah. Yeah. And this of course leads to the shredding of the gremlin. This is kind of the first film had all the horrible deaths for gremlins in the kitchen. This time it gets to take place in a business environment. So the shredder absolutely has to eat a gremlin.
And then we also find it. Well, eventually, Billy and Clamp meet up, and Billy explains what's going on to him. And he's like, they formulate a plan where they're going to get all of the gremlins together in the lobby, and then they are going to open up the shutters to shine sunlight in on them and kill them. They're going to fry the gremlins that way. And Daniel Clamp is going to execute the outdoor portion of this plan by going through his secret escape route, which is like a little like tube that comes up under a tree on the sidewalk.
Yeah, and once he gets out, Dick Miller's character is there. He goes into the tube so he can go inside to help and, of course, fight gremlins.
Yeah, Dick Miller's very excited about fighting gremlins.
The Daniel Clamp character also, like, it's interesting that he's very quick to be like, oh, yeah, I see that gremlins are a problem. Let me help. Mm-hmm. And he's reasonably helpful throughout the picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, like he doesn't throw up any roadblocks to fighting the gremlins. For that matter, Christopher Lee's character as well, once he encounters the gremlin horror, he's not like, oh, well, we must harness this power for our genetic experiments. No, he's freaking out too. And I think even squares off animal testing before being killed by electricity gremlin.
Yes.
We were talking beforehand, this may be the only human character that dies in the whole picture.
Well, but also maybe Leonard Maltin. It's unclear whether Leonard Maltin survives his gremlin mauling.
Yeah, he might have fought him off and go on. But I love that scene too, because he's really digging into Gremlins 1. He's like, this film is just trash. And the gremlins are creeping up behind him, of course. And then they jump him and they start trying to strangle him with film footage.
So eventually we set up for the finale where Dick Miller sneaks into the building. He hooks up with Billy, Kate, and Marla, and they end up using a fire hose and electricity gremlin to melt all the other gremlins. Such a classic movie monster ending, to set a trap and use electricity to kill the monsters.
Yeah, because they were going to do the sun, but clouds. And so this is the backup plan. Electricity gremlin has been stuck for a good portion of the film in call waiting. Somehow, I don't try and think about it too hard.
Yeah, they put him on hold.
But they did. They put him on hold, so he's held. His electrical potential is in there. And his electrical potential is seemingly almost limitless. I guess when they blast electricity gremlin into the flooded hall, the flooded chamber that's filled with all the other gremlins that are transforming and popping off other gremlins, he has enough electricity to just melt and gooify all of them. And I guess in the process, he's destroyed as well.
Yeah, I think that's the case. And it makes me think, well, how much electricity would the rat battery have produced if it had consumed that? I mean, would you have made like a rat that would be lethal to entire city blocks?
Well, I think they were not putting too much of the mutagen in the rat, because the rat retained its physical form and just produced electricity. Electricity gremlin becomes electricity.
Yes.
But still, to your point, like, maybe Splice of Life was doing good work. Like, what if they could have harnessed the power of electricity gremlin to, like, solve the energy crisis?
That would be an interesting ending. Yeah, despite all of their unethical research, we do eventually find a limitless source of clean energy in gremlin form. And of course, the movie ends with a childlike Daniel Clamp. He sees the drawing that Billy has created of his hometown, which Billy was chastised for earlier, I think, by Robert Picardo, saying, like, you know, this is not real art. Clamp sees this drawing of his hometown, and he decides that he must create an artificial fake small town based on that drawing, and he will call it Clamp Corners. And everybody just seems okay with this.
This is after, I should also mention, when the SWAT team comes in at the end, after the gremlins have been killed with electricity, Daniel Clamp is like leading the charge, and they've let him dress up in full SWAT team gear, and he's armed.
Yes.
Which was a weird choice.
They armed Clamp, and fortunately, they didn't need it, because all the gremlins were already melted. Oh, and then Daffy Duck riffs the end credits.
Yeah, yeah, Porky Pig. Well, this is after the credits roll. It's like, this is the stinger. Porky Pig shows up to say, that's all, folks. And then Daffy Duck shows up and says, no, I'm going to do it. And yeah, that's the film. Oh, I should mention too, this is after the credits roll with some more of the score by Jerry Goldsmith.
Oh, yeah, pretty good score, I think.
Yeah, yeah, it's got that nice da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yeah. You know, it's catchy.
It's G2, baby. You can't beat this movie. This is so good.
It is indeed a party to which everyone was invited. Like, again, there's so many cast members and cameos that we could have profiled here that we just didn't have time for. There's so many just little elements, especially in the last half of the film. There's just so many little things, so many scenes of gremlin mischief. There's the training montage where Gizmo trains up and then becomes this Rambo type uh-huh. figure and slays the spider gremlin to save both Bloodstone what's her name? Saves Phoebe Cates from the Spider Gremlin. Like, there's just so many moments. Like, there's no wasted energy in this film.
Gotta love it. Not a Christmas movie, but a good one for any time of year.
Absolutely. All right, well, we're going to go and close it out there, but we'd love to hear from everyone out there. Perhaps you have opinions and memories and theories concerning Gremlins and Gremlins 2. Write in. We'd love to hear from you. Likewise, yeah, any of the various cameos and fun cameos that we didn't have time to mention here, bring them up in listener mail. We'll talk about them in the future. Reminder that we're primarily a science podcast in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind feed with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, listener mail on Mondays, Artifact or Monster Fact on Wednesdays. But on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird film like this one. If you want to see a quick listing of all the films that we've covered, you can go over to Letterboxd. That's Letterboxd. We have a profile there. Our username is Weirdhouse. And we have a list there of all the films that we've covered. And you can look at them in order that we have covered them. I think we're up into the mid-90s now. We're edging closer to 100.
Oh yeah, we're getting close now. We got to discuss what's going to be our 100th film. Anyway, huge thanks to our audio producer, Max Williams. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.